I'll certainly be grateful for your prayers. Eve Carson went to Clark Central High School in Athens, Georgia. She was a beautiful child, little blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl, came from a typical home, excelled in just about everything she did. While she was in school, she was involved in athletics. She was a president of the student council. She was a valedictorian of her class. And at the same time, she was vice president of the National Honor Society. And while living in Athens, she volunteered for the Athens Area Attention Home, which was a safe house for abused and runaway teenagers. Spent time counseling with them and trying to teach them how to protect themselves, provide shelter and comfort for them. She was a page in the United States House of Representatives. If you know what that means, representatives choose from among the best teenagers in their district to serve with them for typically a year or sometimes less, maybe during the summer months. And their job is small, carrying messages, clerical duties and so forth. But for a 16-year-old, that's excellent experience, and it's high marks that she'd won the recognition and approval of her school. The superintendent had to recommend her, and otherwise the representative had to find her, but she had that honor. And she became a lab assistant while she was still in high school at the University of Georgia. When she graduated, she went to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and was a student at the University of North Carolina there. While she was in college, she participated in and led a number of organizations and service projects. She was selected to be a North Carolina fellow, take part in a 4-year leadership development program. She served as the co-president of the Honors Program Student Executive Board and as co-chairwoman of the University of North Carolina's chapter of Nourish International, a hunger relief organization. Obviously a caring person, was involved in helping the hungry, not only in the United States, but around the world. She was also a member of the Committee on Scholarships, Awards, and Student Aids, the Academic Advising Program, the Chancellor's Committee for University Teaching Awards, the Chancellor's Search Committee, the University of Chapel Hill Board of Trustees, and the Carolina Leadership Development Board, and the Athletic Council, and was an orientation counselor at freshman camp. So when new students were coming into the school, after she got to be a sophomore and a junior, she participated in training for the new ones to help them learn how to do. Altogether, I would say, an accomplished young woman, wouldn't you? She was inaugurated as president of the University of North Carolina's student body in April 2007. It was her senior year at Chapel Hill, and she was the president of the student body. And she also studied overseas. She was involved in helping even select professors for the different classes. She made it a point to be involved with the younger students who were perhaps having difficulties. She was someone they could come and talk to about their needs. When she had the opportunity to do it, she went to Egypt and studied, was involved in scholastic works there, and also in South America. She went down there to help establish training programs. She taught computer programming to people in South America, Peru, and was involved in teaching them sanitation, how to take care of themselves, how to prevent diseases. She was in her last, it was Ecuador. She was in her last semester or so of college, had a job lined up at McKinsey and Company, which is a very stable company, as a management consultant, was right on the verge of graduating, and was coming home, coming out to her vehicle, from an engagement one evening, rather late. As it happened, Lawrence Lovett, who was 17 years old, and DeMario Atwater, who was 21, were also in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, that night, and they didn't have any money, and they wanted some. So they decided together, let's go find somebody to rob. And while they were driving around, came by the university campus, right at the time when Eve Carson happened to be walking out by herself to her car. And they forced their way into her vehicle after she was in it and drove off with her, entirely against her will. They both were later put on trial for murder. And the 17-year-old on the stand was asked, what happened in the car when you had her there? But I guess he wasn't old enough to have learned to conceal all of that sort of thing. And besides, it's a sort of thing like acid in your heart that would sear your conscience forever. He said, she started out by telling us, you don't have to do this. They took her to an ATM, and they were unsuccessful in getting money there, and they took her then on to several more. Sin's not really very clever a lot of the time. The ATMs had cameras on them. They took pictures. It wasn't very long before these young men's pictures were seen everywhere, and they seemed completely unaware that such a thing could be happening. They managed to get $700 at one of the ATMs, and when the younger gentleman, Lawrence, was asked about this on the stand, he said she kept telling us, because she had experience with life and she knew about these things, she said, you don't have to do this. I have counseled young people like you before. I know that I can help you get started on a better way. This is only going to lead to trouble. You can't get away with this. It's not going to work. And they didn't listen to her. They kept going. And after a while, they told her, we've got to kill you because you've seen our faces. And she realized then that the situation, I don't know how it could get much worse, but it was escalating to another level. And she started begging for her life. So Lawrence said on the stand. And finally, she said to them, let's pray. She was reaching to the last possible depth of conscience, of sense of right and wrong, of human sensibility, fair play, that she could possibly think of in a desperate effort to save her own life. And possibly, who knows now, thinking within her own mind, I'm probably going to be in eternity before long. I want to do some praying. Well, those of us who have stood on the brink of eternity a time or two realize if you're ever going to be serious about your soul, it'll be then. And it isn't hard when you're looking eternity squarely in the face, right into the hollow sockets of grim death itself. It isn't hard to think about some things that I wish I'd done better, to ask the Lord to have mercy on me. The person gets there, you realize you need the mercy of the Lord. So she cried and she begged and she asked them to pray with her. She invited them, let's have prayer together. So said Lawrence. But they ignored her pleas. After they'd gotten all the money that they thought they could, took her somewhere, really wasn't far enough away because people in the area heard the gunshots and shot her 4 times with a 25 caliber pistol, and she was still alive, and so they shot her in the head with a shotgun. Well, they were caught. What a needless thing. They drove around for 2 more days and managed to extract a little over $1,000 from others of her accounts, but there was too much evidence. The police had the pictures. They had the testimony of people who'd seen the abduction take place. Her vehicle was known. It wasn't long before she herself was found. As you can imagine, the funeral was one of the largest in that part of the state in recent times. How foolish. How foolish to do that to somebody with such a bright, promising life before them. From all we can find of what her legacy is now, wanting nothing more than to be good to people, had spent her life when she didn't have to, trying to care for people just like these. And then for really $2,000 that they got to keep 4 or 5 days, throw it all away. It's just meaningless to them. Did I say meaningless? It must have done something to Lawrence's soul for him to be so affected by the words that she said that when he was on trial for his very life himself, rather than conceal all the evidence, the words came spilling out of him that he would never be able to forget of what she said when she was in her hour of greatest desperation. And I'm sure they echo in his mind still. So they were tried and they were convicted. The judge gave DeMario a life sentence plus 28 years. And he gave a similar sentence to Lawrence, but his sentence was overturned on appeal because the Supreme Court ruled that it is cruel and unusual punishment to give somebody who's a minor, who's still 17, a life sentence. The state of North Carolina waited till he turned 18 and did it all over again, and he got the same sentence that he had gotten before. Both of them are still in prison today. Well, they had long criminal records. Even at 17, had already been arrested several times and been in trouble. And the 21-year-old had drug convictions. He had violence crimes charged to him, illegal gun possession and so forth. And now it's over. Now it's over. And for whatever pleasure they got out of that, their lives are finished. They'll never, either one of them, live prison, almost certainly. I suppose it's fair to say the state did what it had to do. I suppose if I'd sat on the jury, I would make the same sentence. I don't want to sentence anybody to be put to death by the state, because I don't want to be responsible for sending somebody into eternity unprepared. But there are people in the world that I don't think should ever draw another breath of free air. Nevertheless, both of these young men have souls. Both of them are going to be in eternity somewhere. Both of them have a story. If we could look into their background, which I could not, I wonder who their parents were. I wonder why it is that before they were even really men, they learned the ways of the street instead of the ways of honor and dignity. Who allowed this travesty to happen? And if you continue to trace it, how many generations does it go back before in the lives of these young men you find anybody who was really qualified to be a role model? So I think of this. I know people have been being cruel to people ever since Cain and Abel. However, it seems to me that the fear of the Lord is being lost in our world today. Now, this happened in 2008. It's lost in the statistics. Perhaps you had never even heard of this story before. She's just only one of thousands every year. It's depressing to go into Walmart sometimes, or truck stop, and see the missing posters on the wall. 13-year-old children, 12-year-old children, last seen months ago. Nobody knows where they are. Many of them are never recovered. Shame on the devil. Sadness to our nation that things like that occur. When I see those things, it makes me feel maybe we preachers should be doing better than we are in some ways. Teaching the gospel is the greatest defense that there is against the wickedness of vile hearts and deep sin. The reason that Eve Carson, clever as she was, accomplished as she was not able to save her own life was because whatever sense of right and wrong these young men had was so calloused under by the vileness of sin, the dark attitudes that are in the world that she could not penetrate through that enough to touch them. Look like if you had a helpless young girl in the back seat of your car crying and begging earnestly for your life, any man with any manhood in him would find the tears running down his cheeks too. Sorrowful. It's natural in a man to want to protect family, home, children, women. It's natural. But had it all been somehow buried, subdued in these people? They weren't born that way. Life had educated them to be that way. The 19th chapter of Psalms says, "The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." I think these men had lost the fear of God. I think the dark rushing tide of filthiness, of vile entertainments, of vile music, of drug abuse and other substance abuse, the unmanageable flood of broken homes and broken childhoods, I think it is wreaking havoc on our society today. And at the root of all of that is the thing that destroys the fear of God out of people's lives. The Bible spoke of some who became fierce, implacable, cannot despising father and mother, hating authority. How do people get to be that way? It happens because the authority that should have shielded and protected them somehow was taken away. That covenant broken, left on their own, left to feel hopeless and abandoned and broken beneath it. Truce breakers. People are truce breakers when they feel that others have broken truce with them. That's what's going on in our world around us today. A lot of it is going on. I hope I haven't depressed you with this story. But in one sense, I'm not sorry for it. It is the truth. Do you ever get bored with our meeting? Does it ever seem not worth the trouble to come? Folks, this is what we have that separates us from what's going on in a dark and sinful world. I don't know what kind of person Eve Carson was. I know she had some fear of God. I don't know if her prayers were penitent enough to avail at that moment. I'm afraid to say that God abandoned her. That's the point of saying that. I'm afraid to say that she was a hypocrite and therefore the Lord wouldn't hear her. And therefore our young people are so protected from this kind of thing because of our prayers for them that it couldn't happen. I'm afraid to say that. I've known some people who had children who were murdered. We believe that God hears our prayers. We believe it's important to pray our prayers. I also believe, and I hope you do, in the security of the associations that we have with one another and the bonds that we make with one another that teach us to not be in places like that unprotected. You mothers, have you taught your daughters, don't be walking in a parking lot by yourself at 10 o'clock at night? It's dangerous. There are people out there who are not compassionate to your frailty and weakness. And they can hurt you. Well, that's what happened in this case. As to these young men, well, several years went by, and one of them was interviewed discussing it, and the officers who interviewed him said, "It's amazing. These several years have gone by, and he's suffering every day from it. And he has not a shadow of remorse." You have the impression to be around him that if he had the chance, he would do all the same things again. Didn't learn anything. Folks, the fear of the Lord is clean. What these people did is dirty. There's nothing noble about it. The things that God wants us to have in our souls are clean and pure. It begins with the fear of God. It begins with us knowing that there's something inside us, each of us, that knows the difference between right and wrong. And it is so compelling, we have got to do whatever it takes to keep that conscience clear. We can't afford to sear our consciences. And it progresses from there into the whole system of what we call religion. I really am my brother's keeper, and you are your brother's keeper. We owe every person in this world a debt of love, of respect for the living soul that God put within them, compassion toward their souls. The fear of the Lord is clean, and it lasts forever. What these men have won't last forever, but the fear of the Lord never stops. One of these young men said to Eve Carson, and that's when she knew that the worst was going to happen. We have to kill you because you've seen our faces. Where are they now? What does that mean now? Folks, when the devil wants you to do wrong, he's always got a reason to give you that makes it seem just as logical, like it's the only rational course to follow. And in the end, it always comes down to that same point, the struggle between doing the thing that's the easy way out and doing the thing that something within us knows is right. The fear of the Lord is clean. Lord, help us follow the clean way. The fear of the Lord brings confidence and dignity and self-respect because it causes us to want to do the right thing. When you set yourself to do the right thing and you live among other people who do the right thing, confidence builds, trust builds, love has its place to flow. It's that way in every part of our lives. If we want our children to honor us, we need to win their appreciation, to their little young developing hearts to know they can trust us, that we care about them. I feel sorry for a child who has the feeling with his parents, if I'm in enough trouble, my cries will cause you to stop what you're doing. I'm not sure I said that very well. Let me try it this way. I had a daughter who couldn't tolerate being spanked. I don't know why, but she'd get hysterical if I tried to spank her. So I never did, really. Not to that extent. I wanted her to know when she was absolutely desperate that I was going to hear what she had to say. I would sit her down and talk to her. Why does this stress? I tell her, I can't let you do wrong. There has to be a penalty for this, and there's going to be. And she had begged me and say, not that, anything but that. I give something, but don't paddle me. Don't strike me. I listened to her. I feel sorry for a child, and I've known some who had the feeling that no matter how much it hurts, no matter how desperate my need, my leg's broken and I can't run, and you don't realize that it's broken, and you're still hitting me anyway, and feel like they can't get through. Maybe say that this way. I was working in a house one time. It was on a Saturday. Man was cleaning up outside, and he had three boys there working with him. I heard him screaming, and I stepped over to the door. They were desperately telling, please don't hit me anymore. I'll work. He'd left them there to pile rocks and boards and gone off for 2 or 3 hours, probably got something to drink, and came back, and they hadn't done as much as he thought they should. Boys are like that. He was beating them with a 2x4. And their little cries made no difference. As soon as he saw me in the doorway, he stopped. What he was doing is different when a man got there. I feel sorry for children who feel they don't have a way that they can touch somebody who cares, that when they're in their desperate need, there'll be nobody there to help them. The fear of the Lord brings confidence and dignity. It produces a platform that earns trust with our children. It isn't necessarily indulgent, but it is compassionate, and that's how the Lord wants us to be with our own families. I wonder now what those young fellows think and what memories haunt their minds at night. Now, they have souls too. Maybe there's somebody here today. I hope not. We have young people growing up, and they're soon going to make their choices out in the world. Pardon me if I seem too gloomy. But it's hard not to take advantage of the opportunity to impress on our young people and our children as deeply as we can the urgency of being careful about rejecting the values that mother and dad and the church teach you. It's just a few more days and you'll be old enough to take life into your own hands and you can do what you want to with it. Oh, and the world is there with a voice that's always louder than the voice of the Lord. The voice of the Lord is a soft voice. It's a gentle voice. The voice of temptation is a siren call. It's trumpeted in practically everything that we see around us. It's on the billboards. It's on the radio. It's everywhere you look. And yet, it's a voice that will lead to a place where you have memories in your mind, like these young fellows do, that they will never be able to erase. Like this. My father knew a deputy sheriff. My father was a mild man. But the deputy told him in a confiding moment, "Cliff, don't ever kill a man." He killed a man once in the line of duty. He said, "I don't care how justified you are. You never get that out of your mind. It haunts you." We weren't constituted by God to be able to live in sin. Do you hear what I said? We don't have the emotional makeup to deal with sin. We were made to be right. And if you do things that are sinful, they haunt your mind. You can't get away from them, the memory of it. What do you think these boys think about when they lie down on their bed at night? Don't you know her face comes up before them again? And the horror of those moments and how they steal their heart? The devil tells you it's just for right now and it'll be over. She's still moving. Shoot her again. That haunted the people who heard it in the courtroom. What do you think it did to these young men? Young folks, the devil wants to scar your mind with that if you let him do it. May not be like Eve Carson was, but he's got something out there. And you can get memories that you will never get away from. These young men can get saved. They can get forgiven. I believe it. But they'll never get this out of their minds. You young folks, if you dare to go out these chapel doors and choose a life that's going the wrong way, you can come and get saved again, but you'll damage yourself in ways that you can never get back from. The classic example is two young men riding in a car, racing, drinking, misbehaving, got in a wreck, one of them lost an arm in the accident. He can get saved. He's always going to have his arm gone. No matter how saved you get, turn your back on the Lord, you're going to get some things wrong that you can never get back again. So with these, listen, the judgments of the Lord are true. He's not fooled. One day these young men will both be in eternity, and the great judge of all will consider their backgrounds, where they grew up, how others treated and mistreated them. None of us can fully know or evaluate that. And he has mercy according to what it was. He also knows, as no one else does, every time that he came by to deal with their souls. Have you ever had that happen? Have you ever had that happen? I didn't live in sin very long, as those things go. I was 16 when I really put in for salvation. The summer before that, I was making wrong decisions. I couldn't sleep. I lived in a two-story house, and I was upstairs, opened my window at night, and climb out the window. My parents were asleep, and walk for miles through the countryside and look up at the heavens and think to myself, God is up there somewhere. And if something happened to me before I get home, I'd be lost forever. I wouldn't have any hope for my soul. I ought to pray, but I don't have any right to pray because I'm living in sin and I know it. God knows every time that he deals with us, and he knows when he talked to these young men before they let their hearts get that hard. I can say that another way. When my wife and I prayed diligently for our children, I will never forget. One night, she found our son, and he was weeping. And she asked him what happened. And he said, "God spoke to me." Have you ever had that? I tell you, folks, that's the greatest means we've got for our children to get saved. When the Lord comes by, mother and dad say it, and we say it here in meeting and the Sunday school teachers, but when the Lord comes by and talks to you, and you know it, and it's real, and it changes you, the Lord knows every time he talked to these young men, and there were some He's faithful and just to deal with every one of us. He's just in his dealings. He's righteous in everything that he does. And so he had these occasions with them. When we meet him at the judgment, he is able to call every one of those back. They're as real to him as they were when they happened. If we are faithful to them, he is faithful to lead us by them into his plan of salvation. If we reject them, it provides a callousness over our hearts that was so deep, Eve Carson's greatest thrusts could not penetrate it. The Lord's judgments are righteous. Mine are not as righteous as his. If I'd have been there and I could have stopped this, I would have. You look at something like this and say, civilized people say it. The people at her funeral, the police officers, they said it. I wish I could have been there with my pistol. It wouldn't have turned out this way. I'd have done something. That's my judgment. I don't know why the Lord allows that sort of thing in his world. I've got to leave that in his hands. The scripture said, the judgments of the Lord are righteous. And we have to accept that in this world, folks, because if we don't, it'll drive you crazy. There isn't enough answer in this world to justify the stupendous fact that sin is in the world. That somehow we humans have the terrible power to turn our backs on everything that is noble and upright and walk square away from it and deny Almighty God. It's a stupendous fact, and the Lord permits that to happen. I don't know why. I only know this. The judgments of the Lord are righteous. So I have to accept that and leave it in his hands. But I recommend to you, to all of us, that we walk in the fear of the Lord, that we accept his ways are just and that they are righteous, and that we entreat him to have mercy on us, that we keep our own souls clear of the dreadful indictment that fell over the families that were involved in this because of the devil, because of the works of sin. I can't say all the burden that's in my heart. I'll try it this way one more time. This salvation, these worship services, even if they seem boring, even if they get tired of them, they're what we have to keep us from the sinfulness that's in the world. It's all around us. Thank you for your attention this afternoon. Amen.